Hey, this show is brought to you by Audible. Love Audible. Mm-hmm. Audible is the world's leading provider of audiobooks with over 150,000 titles to choose from. They literally have everything, everything. And as you know, today's guest is Henry Rollins, and he has so many great titles on Audible. And I highly recommend his narration of 310 to Yuma. So, so good. You can get that or any other free audiobook on Audible just by going to audiblepodcast.com/RuPaul. That's right. Get a free audiobook and a 30-day free trial at audiblepodcast.com/RuPaul. Please support them since they support us. And Michelle, you've got a book.
I do have a book, and it will be on Audible as soon as I record it.
Okay. Well, we will all be looking for
it. Ain't nobody else voicing my book but me.
Oh, good. Well, wouldn't it be interesting, though, if Henry Rollins voiced your book?
It would. I'd love him to play your role.
Oh, that would be good.
Yes.
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 Go to audiblepodcast.com/RuPaul. Okay, Michelle, let's talk about Adam and Eve.
Oh, yeah, yeah, girl.
Yeah, Adam and Eve is the largest distributor of lubes, X-rated films, and toys for the bedroom. Listen, those toys aren't just for the bedroom. You know, there are other places to use these toys.
For what, like Christmas Day?
I don't know. I mean, come on, you could be creative. I mean, if you're going to adamandeve.com for, you know, sex toys, mm-hmm. you can use them anywhere.
I have a pocket rocket that I use in my car in traffic.
Yeah, fly me to the moon.
Many, many years, lots of traffic in Los Angeles.
Yeah.
What else are you going to do?
Listen, Michelle, you've got a long way to drive.
I do.
You know, so, you know, if you can dream it, they probably have it on adamandeve.com.
Yeah.
But guess what? Adam and Eve wants to give you more.
Give me more,
yes.
more.
If you use the offer code RUE at checkout, you'll get free shipping and 50% off almost any item.
What?
Yes, honey. That's adamandeve.com, offer code RU, RUE, for free shipping and almost 50% off any item.
I'm going now.
Okay. Hey,
hi.
It's RuPaul. Michelle, what's the tea?
Hello.
Hey, you know, now a little birdie told me that you're a fan of plastic surgery.
The little birdie that you've known for 30 years.
Now, what is this about you and your breasts?
I am seriously, and I'm not even saying this for attention, I'm seriously considering having explant surgery, taking them out.
Okay. Okay. From what I know about you, mm-hmm. and you have been obsessed with breasts. Since day one.
Yes.
And you, you've had three breast augmentations.
Yes, to make them bigger.
To make them bigger.
Yes.
They're the size of your head.
Yes.
And what would possess you to say, I'm going to have them taken out?
There's a few
things. Oh, to make them bigger?
No. Out.
Then out. What would happen to all that skin?
That's okay. See, this is what we can talk about.
God.
If I was on good work, we'd be talking about this. They have come a long way with explant surgery. Like, it's not no longer just kind of flibbity, flobbity, deflated balloons, crepiness.
Right.
There's ways of actually going in and almost acting like a corset on the inside of the breast and being able to pull it up. The scarring might not be gorgeous, but I'm not posing for Playboy anytime soon, so it's okay. But they can make them look good with the existing breast tissue that I do have with my implants.
Right.
But,
why would you do it? Why would you do it?
Here's the thing. I feel like I've created my autoimmune disease myself. And I think my body trying to fight off, it's got something foreign in it. And it's had it in since I'm 21 years old.
Mm-hmm.
Three different surgeries. I think my body and my autoimmune disease was partially caused by my body constantly trying to fight and trying to adapt with something foreign in it. Now, it could be my own thing, because if you look it up, there'll be no data that links autoimmune to having implantation. Right?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
But I feel like that's a part of it.
Mm-hmm.
I also feel like it's been done. And I feel like my boobs are so big that they make me look bigger than I really am.
Mm.
I don't feel like I need to have 500 cc's of big silicone blobs in my body anymore.
Mm.
When I told my husband and my daughters, my youngest Lola literally said to me, she goes, well, there goes your career.
She said that.
To my face.
You're kidding me.
And I was like, Lola, my career started before I had implants. Thank
uh-huh.
you very much.
Uh-huh.
And yes, I play it up because I love the kind of Mae West, Diane Brill. I mean, I love that kind of silhouette. It's so
right.
hyper feminine. But at this point, I want people to see more than just giant breasts when they look at me.
So you would not put other implants in there?
No.
You would just take them out. You don't, but do you have any tissue? Like any?
Yeah, you do. I mean, at 46 years old, when I had my last set done, which was 10 years ago, he said that there was a lot of breast tissue in there. Mm-hmm. Because new breast tissue does grow. It, you know, it keeps growing. Your breasts don't keep growing, but the tissue does, you know, mm-hmm. on the inside. I can't really explain it because clearly I'm not a doctor. But what I know is that there is existing breast tissue that is in my breast. So maybe I could be a B cup, you know, maybe, maybe not. But I would have health. And I really think that my breast implants are causing a bit of my not perfect health.
Well, listen, you are highly psychic and you're probably right,
yeah.
but there is no evidence that they're leaking or anything.
No, there's no leak. They're actually great. They're fine. That's why I'm in no rush to do it now. This is something I'm thinking, you know, when we have time off somewhere in the next year or two, about taking them out and just leaving them out. Because
Well, when you have yours taken out, I will have my facelift live on television.
Do you really think that you're going to have a facelift?
I've wanted a facelift for years.
I know.
For years.
But that doesn't mean that you'll do it.
Well, the thing is this. I have been working so much that I haven't had the opportunity to do it. You know, Dr. Dubrow from the show Good Work that I do, he invited me into the operating room to watch him perform a facelift on one of his patients. And I wasn't sure how I would react because I can't watch it on television. I have to close my eyes when I see it on television.
Because
people being cut or anything like that or any blood or anything like that. I was like, oh,
you don't do well with that.
No.
Okay.
But I scrubbed up, went in there. He told me, look, if you're going to fall or pass out, remember to pass out away from the patient. if you feel upset, if your stomach is upset and maybe something might come out, do not do it toward the patient. So I scrubbed up, went in there, nothing. I felt like I was watching the hands of God. It was where
you're hilarious.
Flesh and the spirit meet. Michelle, it was one of the most beautiful things I've ever seen
in beautiful?
My entire life. Because I felt the presence of, for lack of a better word, God.
Uh-huh.
It was a human body on this table. And he had opened her up and had repaired. He had he had tied together some of the muscles and tightened them.
Uh-huh.
She had a full facelift.
Uh-huh.
He tied together the chooky bits under the neck, you know, the stringy bits under the neck.
Yes.
It's a 53-year-old woman. And the whole time I was sending her lots of love energy. Because there's a certain compassion and reverence for the human body in that arena, in this place.
Yes.
It was beautiful. In fact, you know, I can easily say it's one of the top 10 events in my life that I've ever
seriously
top 10 events that have ever happened to me in my life to be in an operating room while someone is having their face lifted.
So now you've just solidified that you want to do it more than ever.
I want to do it more. He told me that he said that I could be back in front of the cameras in 10 days.
Did he say you need one?
He said that, you know, listen, I'm 54 years old.
Yes.
What happens naturally is that the lower part of the face, the jowly part, like right here.
Oh, I don't want to talk about that word. Don't ever say that word in my presence.
Jowly.
Stop it. Don't ever say that word again. No.
Well, that thing, that's what happens. Gravity has, so you want to lift. He says the only problem would be this scar behind my ear.
Because you are,
Because I have
bald.
No hair.
Right,
exactly. And I said, screw that. Why don't you do some type of a tribal cutting thing on my head? Turn it into a party. Turn it into something that is a decorative.
Make it a design.
Make it a design.
Yeah.
You know,
I
probably could. Look at all the skin. You could pull all this up right here and do some like tribal thing on my head.
Like a zigzag.
Yeah. And it would be gorgeous. And, you know, it wouldn't be an issue.
Okay, but if he can, and he has to do it the traditional way, because that's what he knows.
I wouldn't care.
You're okay with
I wouldn't
that.
Care. You know, I live my, you know, I'm on drag, I'm on TV. We can cover it with makeup.
And if you did it on live TV, everybody know you'd have it anyway. And why is it so taboo anyway?
I'll tell you this, because I've been doing a lot of press for Good Work. I'll tell you why it's taboo. Because the press will truncate your life's work and your accomplishments into one sentence in the UK Mail online. And it would say, surgically enhanced drag queen so-and-so. Or, you know, They would always, they would then add surgically enhanced right. to whatever
or trying
you
to
do.
Hold on to youth or youth obsessed.
Exactly. Actress. And so there's a shame attached
to. It's not fair.
But life's not fair. But there's a shame attached to vanity. We live in a Christian Judeo culture where if you are vain, you are looked down upon. But, you know, you put a new roof on your house. Nobody says
roof obsessed
anti-leaking homeowner.
That's your new nickname. You're an anti-leaking homeowner. I always knew that about you.
You rotate your tires. You put new tires on your car. Yeah. But with this body that we live so much longer now
yes.
than we did before.
Why not be happy with
why
it?
Why not be happy
it's
with
mine.
It?
It's mine. You don't have yeah. to like what it looks like. It's right. mine. Yes. It makes me happier.
That's right. That's right. So,
do you really think you're going to do it?
I do think I'm going to do it. You know, I've been doing temporary facelifts when I'm in drag for years.
Yeah.
I use the Mark Trainer tapes. If you read my book, I go in depth into this in working it. But I've used those for years and yeah. it's made all the difference. But, to have a surgical procedure to tighten up everything.
Oh, that's a big step.
It is a big step. But, I'm willing to take that one wow. small step for mankind,
I
Michelle.
I hear that.
Yes.
Do it.
So, and now that I'm doing this show and being around Dr. Dubrow, he knows all of the latest and greatest of what's happening right now.
I love that.
Because it changes so fast.
I'm so obsessed
changes
with it.
Changes so fast.
And I'm so obsessed with it now more than ever and have been looking into stuff for the breasts and looking into stuff for the neck. Because when you get to a certain age and the products all say, like, I'm staying up at night and I'm obsessing over Perricone Sub-D neck lift. And I'm like reading the research and everybody's going, well, I got a rash from that. I got uh-huh. no lift and I got a really bad rash. And then you hear other surgeons talk about how neck skin is so different than face skin. And they haven't perfected the neck lift the way they perfected the facelift.
Right.
You know, that's a few years off. And it's so amazing how many different people look at things differently. But it is so even more amazing what they can do with
yes.
plastics.
Yes. I love it. I love it.
Yeah.
I tell you, this woman, and he sent me a picture of her later, the woman who I witnessed her facelift. She looks great.
Is she super happy?
Super happy.
That's
I think
what
she's
it's
gonna,
about.
She's super happy. But not only this, but I could tell in the operating room it was a good facelift.
Really?
Yep. I could tell it was really good. He is an artiste.
Yeah. Well, he's the top of his game for a reason.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah.
I love that guy.
That's unbelievable.
I love him. He's
yeah, he's...
A, lovely yeah, person.
Yeah, I agree.
Lovely person. And he's a very, very talented plastic surgeon.
Agree. I agree.
Oh, so, Dr. Dubrow, here I come.
Cannot wait.
Yeah.
Cannot wait.
Hey, so we've got Henry Rollins on the show right after this break. Talk about a renaissance man. This guy, I've known him for years. He is phenomenal. You're going to love him.
Cannot wait. I'm dying to meet him. For years, I was a huge Black Flag fan. I'm totally going to fangirl. And what I love about him most of all is he is super, super smart.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
I can't wait to just pick his brain.
All right. Henry Rollins, right after this. Michelle, I love audiobooks. Now, I know you have a book coming out.
I do.
Will there be an audio version of your book?
You know what? Lots of people on Twitter and all that stuff asking. There absolutely will be an audiobook. I love audiobooks. That's why I love podcasts so much, because I yeah. listen to them when I jog, when I'm driving. I love me an audiobook. And I will be voicing my own audiobook.
Really? That's like when Joan Rivers played herself
yes.
in the TV movie of herself.
Well, the only other person that could voice my book would probably be Melissa Rivers. So it would be perfect. But I'm going to do it. And Audible, by the way, Rue, is the world's leading provider for audiobooks, the ones that we talk about that we love so much. They have over 150,000 titles there.
Wow, that's a lot of books.
It's insanity. And that includes some of Rue's favorites, like Eckhart Tolle's A New Earth, The Power of Now. I was talking about The Artist Way by Julia Cameron,
yeah.
going back and revisiting that because it's so important if you feel kind of stymied or stumped in your creativity process. It's everything you're looking for and more. And you can even listen to your favorite audiobooks on any device. Now, when I say, I mean any device, your phone, your iPad, any device that you've got, you can listen. And what also makes me really excited about Audible is their whisper sync technology, something that I have to start doing more, whispering. lets you switch devices and you save your bookmarks. So you don't have to go back and try to fast forward and figure out where you were.
So my Kindle, I could do that with my Kindle right. or my iPad right. and my iPhone.
So device, 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 you switch, switch, switch. It'll pick up where you left off on all of them. I love that. And don't forget, if you order a title from them and you decide early on that it's not for you, you can even call Audible. They'll let you swap it out for another book free of charge.
That's amazing.
Hello, free of charge.
Yeah.
So for a free audiobook and a 30-day free trial, go to audiblepodcast.com/RuPaul. That's audiblepodcast.com/RuPaul. By signing up for Audible, you'll be saving money and what? Helping to keep our podcast free.
That's right.
Hello. Thanks again to Audible and to you guys.
We are here with Henry Rollins, Michelle.
Legendary.
Legendary. And you know what's funny? When you were coming over, I remember that when you did my RuPaul Drive thing, you pointed over here in Hollywood over to the Trader Joe's, and you said you recorded your first album at that location.
Yeah, different building many, many years ago. The Trader Joe's, the top part of the building,
right.
was an office space that we rented and had SST Records and slept on the floor of. Down below was a recording studio, which leased the entire building. So we rented apartment office space from the record label that also had the studio that we were doing a distribution deal with. So we recorded the Damaged album, the Black Flag, first Black Flag album, on the street level. I think that's like an ATM machine and maybe right. a bank or something.
Yeah.
But it used to be a small recording studio that went away whenever that building came down. But this is kind of my old neighborhood.
Right here. We're in West Hollywood here in Los Angeles, yeah. which is just, you know, it's interesting being on the planet for a while and seeing things come and go mm-hmm. and watch things. What your experience, this is West Hollywood, but this was always a gay area. Am I right?
Gay, yes, but a slightly slippery slope. A certain kind of gay.
Mm-hmm. Right.
In that if you walk up and down the street, you'll see some of the small, low-roofed liquor stores. That's the buildings that were from here to Beverly Hills pretty much when I lived here.
Mm-hmm.
At night, I was from the East Coast. This was a fascinating night world for me. And not having a lot going on besides band practice, I would just walk around to kill time. We had no money. We're not going to go anywhere.
Right.
So I would walk up and down Santa Monica Boulevard, La Cienega, because it was a nighttime world of rent boys, young guys about my age, dressed like in Bowie glitter with gym pants and you know purple gym pants, glitter socks,
yes.
and clogs with makeup.
We know that very well.
But you know, they're young guys.
Yeah.
I'm 20. I'm a kid, and they're kids, and I'm just in some band. They're jumping in cars with men, hoping they don't get their heads cut off.
Right.
I mean, it's raw.
It's yeah. very punk rock.
Oh, yeah.
And you know, some car would pass and yell something mean towards these guys. And these guys are like frail. They're really kind of beautiful looking with their face paint and everything. But they were like swans, you know, beautiful but pugnacious.
Sure.
And the car would drive by and say, hey, you. And then these guys would unleash the most intense, hey, pull out. You know, and you're like, wow, you guys are ready to fight.
Yeah.
And that's what this whole neighborhood was. It was kind of the down and dirty, take a walk on the wild side
sure.
gay.
Yes.
And I'm not trying to say there's different kinds of gay. But then from basically where we're sitting west towards Beverly Hills, in huge infusion of money
right.
came. And as far as like male street prostitutes, you'd see them. And over the years, the LAPD started moving them east, east, east,
right.
east. And at Gardner and Santa Monica, Astro Burger, and
yes.
what used to be Okie Dogs, that used to be punk rockers and rent boys all sitting and eating and hanging out and guys looking for a date. And then that moved east, 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 like down to Bronson because
right.
it was the LAPD herding like, nope, nope, this neighborhood's gentrifying and your time here is over.
Right.
And that's what I watched. And quite often the cops were less than friendly to
sure.
all of us.
Yeah.
And I always felt a real kind of community because you'd be sitting with some guy. He's a runaway from Portland. Mm-hmm. This is how he's making his money. And like, what'd you do today? I had band practice. What did you do today? Well, and you're like, whoa.
Yeah.
Wow. That's more punk rock than I'll be 10 yeah. years on a treadmill trying to be punk rock.
Yeah, yeah. So yeah. Okie Dog is where Fatburgers is?
Yes, and it was a real meeting point for punk rockers. They say go see a show at the Whiskey.
Yeah.
Next stop, Okie Dog, to talk about the show, find out what's going on. We'd go on tour for, you know, these epic voyages and come back. There's no internet. There's no talking drum. So you'd go to Okie Dog's and go, what's been happening since we've been gone?
Mm-hmm.
Which was, he OD'd, she killed herself, he's in jail. It was never good news.
Right. Yeah.
And it was how you caught up with what was happening in your L.A.
Like a town hall.
Yes. And, yeah. and it was kind of where you would get your info because there's no chat rooms. This is the 80s.
It's like PBS.
What year are we talking? This is
early 80s.
Early 80s.
Yeah. And it was interesting to go on tour and come back and people you kind of sort of knew. A lot of fly-by-nighters here. You know, runaways. And
it's transient. Very transient.
Back to Reno or wherever they came from.
I'm not allowed to say that word.
Transient?
Yeah.
Oh, well.
But you know what I mean? They're just like crazy kids. They couldn't hang in Wyoming for whatever reason. Mohawk.
Well, I've been to Wyoming. I know what reason.
Yeah, it's probably time to leave.
Yeah.
You know, if you're different, you got to go.
Yeah.
Something bad could happen.
Yeah.
And so you'd see him and then they'd be gone. You heard some sad story or no story. But what started happening around 83, 84 was cheap heroin came into Los Angeles by the truckload. I mean, it would just come with an order of food. Here's your heroin.
Mm.
And you talk to people. Yeah, I mean, my girlfriend tried heroin last week. Like, you did what? Well, we're not addicted. We do it every other night. Then, no, you are addicted because you can't stop doing it. And your nose is running. Shut up, you Boy Scout. I'm not a Boy Scout. I'm just saying that you have a problem with heroin. And it was like Hoover and COINTELPRO. Like someone's trying to kill us off.
Mm-hmm.
And I was in my 23rd year of living. And it was a real revelation to me. It's around the time I read Ginsberg's epic poem, Howl. Where he said, I've seen the best people of my generation, you know, barking mad in the streets, et cetera. And I said, wow, they're after us. And they're trying to kill us off with drugs. Just like Hoover was working on the ghettos, you know, putting heroin in where the weed used to be.
Yeah, but you know, it doesn't take much because, you know, and I know you're a sensitive, intelligent, sweet soul. You know, the demons from the inside out, I find, were way more insidious than Hoover could have ever
Absolutely.
Been, you know?
They're preying upon people who have been rejected, who are told they are less than. And the way the LAPD would treat us, you'd go up at the Whiskey and we didn't have money to get in, so we'd stand around outside and just kind of loiter. And the cops would come up and basically go, start moving, and, you know, the bullhorn, start moving, and you'd move across the street to where the Viper Room is now. Just keep moving. You'd hang out at Tower Records for a minute, and then you'd just take these endless laps until the band would be doing the last song. They'd let all the stragglers in, hoping they'd buy a beer. And that's when I started noticing the cops were using video cameras, and they're now videoing our faces.
Mm-hmm.
And people started wearing bandanas. Like, wow, we are being cataloged.
Mm-hmm.
And so you're taking people who already didn't fit in somewhere, and they migrated to Hollywood, and now you're making them feel less than. And so someone like that, you're destroying their self-esteem.
Mm.
And when you do that, someone says, here's a bag of something that'll make you feel better, or here's something you can do to make some money. You become open to the ravages and the wild winds of the street.
Absolutely. Absolutely. What do you think, we're talking to Henry Rollins, why do you think that you were able to sidestep that phenomenon?
I had a job.
You had a job.
Yeah, I was in Black Flag.
Yeah.
I had a fuller than full-time job that was an obsession. You know, we're in a band. We're going to play until we drop. We didn't have time or money or resources to get high and watch TV. We had no TV or a couch to lounge on. And we were always in a van going to the next miserable burg to get stuff thrown at our heads.
Yeah, well, there's that. But then, like I said, there's also that inner demon, you know, and yeah, I'm sure you've been around so many sweet, sensitive souls who, you know, the calls are coming from inside the house. How do you sidestep that? Even today, how do you sidestep that?
Because you're in the throes of it. Black Flag was like epic in the punk rock movement.
Epic.
And what are you, well, you're in the throes of it.
I was an angry man, still angry, almost 55 and still mad. And my anger was such that I didn't want to get high because I realized what it was. It's the man trying to slow me down.
Mm.
And so to me, getting high was the enemy. It was never a temptation because people were trying to offer me drugs all the time just to hang out.
Yeah.
And I'm like, nah, it's okay. It's like, really? I'm like, yeah. And they go, how can you resist the temptation? I'd rather drink a bucket of paint. There's no temptation. And I just had my anger and a place to be. And my demons were ambition, talking when I should be listening. I would, you know, being impatient, not knowing much, but you wanting to think that I know it all. You know, like young man stuff.
Yeah.
And that kept me kind of champing at the bit to be really good on stage or write this really well or do something. Yeah. Not exactly a goody-goody, just kind of more military. Sorry, ma'am, I won't do that.
Right,
like,
right.
Because in Black Flag, you get your marching orders and you go out there and you hit it. There was no messing around. Right. We're doing like two shows a night sometimes.
I know, because I know your father was military. Are you more like your father or your mother?
On my good days, I'm a bit like my mom. And on my bad days, as people will attest to, I resemble my dad, who had an incredible temper.
Right.
Was fairly to incredibly rigid and unflexible. What he and I don't share is he was a fantastic racist, an incredible misogynist, and a champion homophobe. And thanks to my mom, none of that was ever my pedigree.
Right.
Because she just raised me right on all that. But I have his temper, but I have both of their work ethic. They both work like crazy people. But on my I'm not listening inflexible days,
right?
The dad comes out.
Right. I think, you know, I think I became aware of Black Flag. I feel like it was either 1980 or 79. I don't remember. But I think it may have been through like some gay magazine having a picture of you with shorts on and all of your clothes off except for a pair of shorts. And that was my first introduction.
Details magazine used to run me almost monthly.
Really?
Yeah, they loved me over there.
Yeah.
Well, nice people.
But was that a plan? Was it just heat? The fact that it was hot in the club? Or was it a branding strategy to get your name out there to say, you know what? I'm going to sell sex.
I wish I had that much going on because that's good marketing. That's smart. But
and in a punk rock band, you didn't get that.
No, you didn't get that.
But the way you see me look in all those photos is because of function. I had one pair of shoes. I owned no underwear. I had no underwear until 1995. It's just more to launder and more to lose and more to carry around. So I have a pair of pants.
That's so epitome of a man right there.
Well, just broke.
Yeah.
And one or two t-shirts. And so you'd finish a show and I would be drenched. Like just drop me in water, but it's my own sweat.
Mm-hmm.
I am now going to go into a van and spoon up with the drummer and sleep in my own ammonia-ating sweat, soaked jeans, like wet denim. It's going to take a week and a half to dry.
Mm-hmm.
Wet sneakers, the salt and the sweat will rot the rubber. Like the sneakers become throwaway items in 2 weeks. And one night I went on stage without shoes. So at least I'd have dry socks and shoes after the show.
Right.
And then I got a pair of used Dolphin running shorts from somewhere, and I started wearing those because I can just take them into the sink of the awful men's room at the venue and wring them out. And then there's no towel, there's no shower at these venues, it's a bar.
Yeah,
I just put on, as I'm caked in dried sweat, put on it relatively dry clothes. It was function and
right.
Nothing more. I don't think I'm body beautiful, nor was I. I have all these cigarette scars on my legs from people putting their cigarettes and sometimes cigars, Denver, out in my legs from having no pants. And so the early days, you'll see me in sweated out pants. But by 84, I'm down to shorts and no clothes because it's less to carry.
Well, yeah, but it's very smart. But as the legacy has continued onto social media and on Tumblr, those pictures are still alive. I see a picture of you on stage with the shorts on once a week on Tumblr. Do you ever see those things?
No.
No. No.
Oh, I maybe, but I don't really. I probably don't even notice. I don't, because
that's a little girl. That's what I was drawn to, darling. Because we didn't have the internet. And I was a huge punk rock fan when I was 13, 14 years old. Blue Mohawk, fell in love with Sid Vicious, fell in love with him. And that's when my love affair with punk rock began. And then when you see somebody like Henry Rollins on stage in nothing but shorts.
Yeah.
And this beautiful kind of punk rock soul up there. It's like, oh my God. And then you start listening to the music. That's when I fell in love with Dave Vanium. And like, that's how I was drawn to these, being that little girl who loved punk rock and loved hot punk rock men.
Well, and so when did you become aware that there was this huge gay following for the band?
Almost immediately.
Yeah.
Because we hung out with the people that no one else wanted to hang out with. Like the crew around Black Flag were some of them were very scary. At least one confirmed killer. Dead now.
Shut up. Seriously.
Yeah, he killed it. One guy for sure. We think two. And that's, you know, that's a whole other chapter. Mm. And we hung out with some very heavy people. We also had a lot of cross-dressers and people like that at our shows because we're the outlaw outsider music. And mm-hmm. if we go backstage at a Black Flag show, there's not a bunch of like pretty girls oohing and aahing over us because we stink. We're in like four-day-old sweat. We had, like in San Francisco, Ginger Coyote's hanging out with us. Bambi Lake, who's a guy who is thankfully still with us, a longtime pal of mine. He's a cross-dresser. And he would go out and he would bring his cassette to the show. He says, can I go out and do my thing? And he would go out and do his Marlene Dietrich thing to open for us. And he'd go and lip sync to Marlene Dietrich in his like four-day-old makeup, which is coming down his face because he's on the streets making his living.
Yeah, yeah.
And our audience was like shocked, repelled. And like, yeah, and you'll get us, you know, our audience could be sometimes a coarse. I'm being really, really friendly there.
Yes, yes.
Get off stage, you know. Yeah. And he'd be up just like doing his best. And he was one of our people. And we would play in gay bars in the South. Like, you know, there's burly, hairy chested men in hot pants would be like, all right. And they were our people. So us and the gay thing, there's, and Washington, D.C., the scene I come from, it was super gay. D.C.'s gay.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
So gay.
Oh, my God, yeah.
Like, my mom's friends were gay. My bosses were gay. I went to an all-boys school by 10th grade. That teacher's gay. Three guys in my English class, gay, gay, gay. Because, yeah. You know, puberty kicks in and everyone becomes themselves.
Yeah.
And you're like, wow. And so we had gay in our world, and guys would come up and just, you know, it's the punk rock days. It was pre-AIDS. Mm. You would just walk up to someone like, hey, you got 7 minutes?
Yeah.
And sometimes girls would hit on me. Sometimes guys would hit on me. And I have a preference. I'm heterosexual. So I said no to the guys who never offended me. And they were always really cool about it. Like, and they're like, and one guy was so funny. He called himself Peaches. He was dressed. He hit on me.
You know, Peaches.
Peaches.
In Little Rock. And like, he's dressing like a chick in Little Rock. Guts.
Yeah,
and
that's punk rock.
And I immediately dug him. I'm like, yeah. Man, you are really, whew, yeah. That takes guts. And he said, I'm Peaches, and let's go outside and do a little business. And I said,
let's make some peaches and cream.
And I said, I dig you, man. But I said, you are wearing the same green hose, you know, like the net stockings that Madonna is wearing in the Like a Virgin video. And he said, I wore them because I know you're a fan of Madonna and you recognize that. And he said, so, and he said, so let's go out and let me make you very happy. And I said, no, that's cool. I mean, what's your real name? He goes, Tim. I go, okay. And he was sitting on my lap as we're having this discussion.
Yeah.
I'm Santa Claus.
Yeah.
And I said, so Tim, no, I can't make it with you because I'm just not cut from that bolt of cloth, but thank you. And he was hilarious. He said, you know what? You should just close your eyes. It'll be fine.
Yeah, it's all the same.
He said, I've already made out with your bass player. it was a guy named Sal. I said, oh, don't tell him.
Right.
Because he won't handle it well.
Oh, because Sal didn't know the T on Peaches.
Or was Sal too drunk to remember?
No, Sal just saw a thing that looked female-like and it was going for him. And
sure.
He just said, okay. And I said, don't tell him. He will not handle it well. No, it wouldn't have gone down well.
Yeah.
But I laughed so hard.
Oh, my God.
And so I had so many experiences like that from the first moments in Black Flag to now. I still get guys saying, are you sure you're not gay?
Mm. Well, no. And that's because when everybody was introduced to your image, it was very calculated. And I'm sure you said it wasn't by you, but it was just the way things turned out. It was sexualized, and it was actually inviting in a way that punk rock had not been before.
Correct.
You were this the sort of poster child for hot pop star, good-looking movie star, good-looking punk rock lead singer. And that's why a whole generation of people still associate you with, you know, being a...
We didn't have that. You didn't have that. Johnny Rotten, no.
No one had done that before.
No, there's not some shirtless guy running around, you know, who looks okay or whatever. I mean, punk rock, it just wasn't... And I got a lot of grief for that. Like, why do you grow your hair? Because two tours ago... You called us hippies, and we are never cutting our hair again. So hippie up on that.
Right, mm-hmm. Right.
You know, we were a very reactionary band. Mm-hmm. And
how long did the band last? It was from what to what?
The band had three singers before me, and they kept leaving because they could. There's one band member they couldn't get along with, so they kept leaving. And so by 1981, three singers had come and gone and done great work. And so there was an audition in New York. I went for it. They were my favorite band. I already knew those guys from previous tours, the other singers. And I made the cut. And so I packed a duffel bag and left my job, my car, my apartment, and all 20 of my records. And I came out here with Black Flag. I met up with them on tour via Greyhound bus. I still have the bus ticket.
Wow.
Oh, wow.
July 1981. And I came out here and moved about two blocks from where we're sitting right now.
Mm-hmm.
And that was and I've been living out here pretty much ever since. And so...
And you had gone from D.C. to New York. What was your plan in moving from D.C. to New York?
Oh, no. I went to New York for the audition.
Oh, for the audition.
I was working a full-time minimum wage job in D.C.
Were you born and raised in D.C.?
Yeah. Mm. Yeah, D.C. General Hospital, now gone. And I went into the minimum wage working world out of high school. I had no plans for my life whatsoever.
None.
None. Zero. And it sounds like an exaggeration. None. I never wanted to be an astronaut or a firefighter. I never had any of that. At a very early age, I was working minimum wage jobs. They're available in my neighborhood back in those days. Park these cars, guard this parking lot, clean out this animal cage, tear these movie theater tickets, you know, $3.50 an hour. Mm-hmm. I did those jobs, loved it, had my own money, loved the autonomy of it, knew how to work a cash register. I loved the adultness, being a 10th grader and having the key to a store on my keychain that I could walk into. The trust of that,
right.
It really turned me on. And so after high school, I said, well, I guess I'll do that 40 hours a week and turn into a Bob Seger song. I'm going to be the guy in a Springsteen lyric, like,
right.
He's working. and you know, it's a kind of job where your feet hurt at the end of the day. You swell up. You're like, wow, man, this is going to be a really tough life. And then I got this break to be in Black Flag. But I came out here still wearing my Haagen-Dazs T-shirts. Because it's some of the only clothes I had, which immediately got stolen by all the band members. And you see photos of Black Flag on stage with a band member wearing a Haagen-Dazs shirt.
Because he worked there. Job?
Yeah, it was my. And so I had like 10 of them because it was my work shirt. You sweat through them, you throw it in the laundry. And it was like some of the only shirts I owned. And I brought them all out here. I still have one and I framed it in a
box. Wow.
The rest are sadly gone. But then bands give you T-shirts and you can fill it out just a bit. But I came out here with a minimum wage mindset of like you work really hard, you get some money and you pay your way, you pull your weight in the world. And that is still the axiom, that's still the way I comport myself to this day. The paycheck has gone up considerably, but the ethic has not changed a dot since I was working for $20 a day. Mm. I show up on time, I'm not high, I know my part.
Yeah.
I'm not here to waste your time, and I'm really grateful that you let me be in your movie or your whatever it is.
Yeah, no, and listen, you've done very well for yourself because, you know, show business was something that sort of happened to you.
Mm-hmm.
And the Black Flag lasted, you were in Black Flag.
5 years.
For five years.
81 to 86.
To 86. And then what happened after 86?
Well, in 86, like a minute after Greg Ginn called me, the leader of Black Flag, he said, I quit. And I said, it's your band. How can you quit? He goes, I quit. I said, okay. I need a band. And so I freaked out for a moment. For after 5 years, you're out of the iron lung. The real world comes in very quick. I'm like, wow, either I hit the ground running or I fold. So I wrote two songs immediately, which became on my first solo album. I was like, had the bass line, the lyric. I said, get moving.
Mm-hmm.
Within a few weeks, I had summoned my old pal from Washington, D.C., a guy I grew up with named Chris. He was living in England at the time. He goes, I've got riffs, I've got tea, I've got a floor you can sleep on, and I've got a rhythm section. Come to Leeds, England. Let's make a record. And I went out there with like $1,700. It's like all I had. Ran out to England. We made this record for nothing. Became my first album. It's called Hot Animal Machine. So I think that's what humans are.
Mm-hmm.
And the next thing we did was we found a new rhythm section, became the Rollins Band. And within 7 or so months, 8 months of Black Flag ending, Rollins' band was in practice in a garage in Trenton, New Jersey. And then by May of 87, about 10 months after Black Flag broke up, Rollins' band was gainfully on tour until Christmas of 87. So I basically went, okay, go.
Yeah.
And I was back on the road, kind of back in the thing, starving in a van, playing in front of, you know, angry people hurling ashtrays, right back to the good old days.
Right, right.
Yeah.
And you know, today, you know, you have done movies, you've done, you've got a television show on, is it History Channel? Is it the TLC, one of those things?
Yeah, it was H2.
But, History 2.
Yeah. But, yeah. My show went away a few weeks ago.
Ah.
And so now I'm scrambling like a quarterback with a blitz coming.
Well, you know, listen, I have no doubt, like Michelle Visage and myself and your work ethic, you will have another TV show momentarily, I'm sure.
I hope so.
No, I'm sure you will. You have that thing. You know, we talk about this on the show a lot. We deal with a lot of young kids who come on our show. And the work ethic that you talked about before that I would probably attribute to going to a boys' school and having a military father, it's missing. It's missing from a lot of young people. And I don't know how to imbue them with that quality.
Yeah, the kids have gotten much too lax about life.
You have to beg them, I think, in that you and I, the three of us, are older than some 18-year-old kid. Our arms had to be a little longer and a little stronger. We had to reach higher because the low-hanging fruit was gone. And we have to realize, okay, I'm going to go into the thick of the adult world. I better bring some game or I'm going to starve. And I'm not saying young people are bad. I quite like them. The reach isn't as long. They get complimented a lot. You know, like, oh, you were great. Here's your prize for losing the game. Like, okay.
talk about this all the time.
And I'm not necessarily against. I'm not one of those hardcore guys. If you don't win, then you should eat a box of cold mud. I don't have that kind of scorched earth policy. But
I do.
And that, fair enough. But I'm saying a lot of younger people, their arms didn't have to be nearly as long or strong. I used to have a manager, a great guy. His children never had day jobs growing up. I'd ask them, like, what do you do in the summer? Like, are you pouring yogurt into a cup somewhere in the valley? Shouldn't you be doing that for ridiculously low? Just so somewhere you can be at 9 a.m.
Yeah.
with an apron on saying, yes, no, may I help you?
Exactly.
It really is good to kind of get broken into the world like that, completely. Like you serve someone.
Yes.
And they're like, no. I'm like, wow, life is going to really do a number on you unless, like, I don't know what you're going to do.
Yes.
And so that's why I said you have to beg them to. Youth write me, there's probably 10 more emails since I left the office since coming here. Henry, what do I do? Learn, don't drop out of school, get your game on, learn how to work, learn where a dollar comes from, like learn how to save and spend your money.
Mm-hmm.
I want to go on the road and be a band. What do I do? If you were going to go on the road and be a band, you wouldn't be writing me for advice. You'd be telling people to get out of your way.
Exactly.
You'd be James Brown star time. Here it comes. I hope I don't hurt you.
Yeah.
You wouldn't be asking me. You'd be telling me, watch this.
Right.
And so if I have like 2 more years in college, should I leave? No. Get the degree. You're going to need an option once you get out there because the numbers are against you in entertainment. This town is full of talented people.
Yes.
Really, really talented.
Really talented.
On every possible voiceover, acting, whatever, it's you and 80 other people who can kick your butt to get that job.
Yeah.
And they're living on top ramen noodles and they will get that job one
yes.
day.
Yeah.
And so you're going to go into that and to not have your parents or not take it upon yourself to prep for that like it's Super Bowl Sunday or like the Octagon or like something really full on like that.
Uh-huh.
You're not only doing yourself a disservice, you're doing anyone that depends on you a disservice. And you come off sounding like some angry scoutmaster or drill sergeant, but you're like, no, I like you, man. You're a young person. I like you unconditionally. That's why I'm telling you this, because you better get it together. And so I just beg them. I go, please prepare.
Yeah. But does that work, though? I mean, I think that's why I keep going back to the military thing, is I think that when you see it in play, and you as a kid, when you see how things work, especially, you know, if you, you know, D.C., I keep going to the military thing because I think that's key. Because you have to be able to willing to die before you can really live. And a military environment will really kill your ego so that it can build you into what it needs you to be.
True.
You know?
And that's how they do it. I mean, my ego is completely trampled upon, destroyed, and just obliterated by a military prep school. I went to a naval prep school from sixth grade to graduation. Stand up! You stand up. Some guy is yelling at you so much his spit is, you're mm-hmm. like, wow, coffee mm-hmm. spit in my face.
Right.
And like, why are you yelling at me? And like, of course, I'm on Ritalin. I'm like a wreck.
Really? You were on Ritalin? How early did you get on Ritalin?
If you'll never find these books, but I've seen them. The early research books on Ritalin, you'll see photos of me in kindergarten.
What?
I went to the National Research Center. I was one of the test group kids for different doses of Ritalin.
For wow. ADHD?
Yeah. One day they give us little yellow ones, then you get the triangular orange ones. And my mom had these books because this little school I went to had a room with all these mirrors. And one day I'm like, well, look at all the mirrors. It's an observation room. One day I see my mom walk out. It's like Parents' Day or something. And then my mom gets these big books, and there's photos of me painting and chewing on my hands. And it's Ritalin. And so I was on Ritalin from like kindergarten till about 11th grade when I rebelled because puberty hit me. And I just started throwing the pills away. And within 3 days, I have a ravenous appetite. I'm alive again. And of course, my grades plummeted, and I'm on the ceiling, you know, being a maniac. But the Ritalin makes you basically sit and vibrate. You're a propeller that spins so fast it looks like it's standing still, but you are speeding. Like that one of the last scenes of 2001 A Space Odyssey, like right. when all the lights yeah. are going by the helmet.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Of Dave.
Yeah.
That's Ritalin. You just sit there like, whoa, baby! Right. And you right. just go hurtling through a day of school.
Right.
And are white you knuckle home on the bus.
And are you an only child?
Yeah.
And so early on they thought, we got to get this kid on something.
Well, yeah, I was a problem in class. And in those days,
they'd be like, kindergarten,
though? Oh, yeah, yelling, disruptive,
very
violent.
Young.
Yeah, but yelling hysterically and like got thrown out of the D.C. public school system for violence. And he, you know.
You're preparing for your punk rock future.
He stood on the back of his chair and yelled. I saw the teacher's reports as a young adult. I read. I said, I did that. My mom said, here's why you got kicked out. And like she showed me, you know. Dear Henry's mom, we're going to cut your kid loose because on this day he stood on the back of his chair and screamed at the top of his lungs and had to be restrained. I have no memory of that whatsoever. I'm sure they're not lying. I read stuff about myself from who's this guy? I did that?
Wow.
I'm horrified at myself. I was a crazy little kid. And so in the back of Boy's Life, you can read about this school. We'll straighten your kid out. Your boy has a learning problem, discipline problem, won't pay attention. Bring him to us.
Did it work? Did the military school work?
Yeah, it breaks you down because you get yelled at a lot. And, you know, these teachers, a lot of them were good and they cared about us. And a lot of them were just burned out, hated their salary, because I went to school with a lot of rich kids and their disciplinary problem because they're at the country club all summer putting golf carts into the pond at the 17th hole or whatever. Is that how many holes they have in golf?
Yeah.
And so they're a discipline problem because their dad bought the tennis court of that school. So when the teacher yells at them, they just smirk because right. nothing's going to happen to that kid. To be political for a moment, I basically went to school with George W. Bush, mm-hmm. the rich kids who didn't get a scratch on them. That's why they're a discipline problem. I was a brain problem. I was just a little maniac. And so I struggled with the uniform and being yelled at is terrifying. And by 10th grade, I was a very angry, kind of crazy person. And then around 11th grade, I heard punk rock. And I was like, finally, someone's as angry as I am. Because you can put on a Led Zeppelin record and enjoy it. But he's singing about mountain fairies and Vikings and whatever. It's not, I love those records.
I love it.
But they're not angry. And then you hear Joe Strummer of The Clash. Hear Johnny Rotten. You hear the disenfranchisement of the Ramones. That's like nobody's music becomes your music.
Right.
Completely.
Yeah. And that, it gave, as Hubert Selby, the great writer, used to say, I was a scream looking for a mouth. That the punk rock was like, well, there goes my scream. It's right there. And it was my insignia on my shield I took into battle from that day in 1970-something to 2015.
I love it. We're going to take a quick break, but I want to find out from you what the anger was about, if you can, if you know what that meant in hindsight. So we've got Henry Rollins. We'll be right back. All right, let's talk about Adam and Eve. They are the world's largest distributor of lubes, X-rated films, and toys for the bedroom.
Do you know, I used to get their catalogs at my mother's house when I was little, and I used to steal them.
From where?
From the mailbox.
Uh-huh.
I'd go get the mail. They wouldn't know that they were there, and I'd take them into my room.
Yeah.
And back then, they had some toys, but it was all about lingerie and stuff like that. But then as you got older, I realized, AdamandEve.com comes in handy.
Right. Now, but of course, when you were a kid,
there was no .com. Yes, I know.
You didn't order anything from then, did you?
No.
Not back then.
How do I get that to the house? No, then there was no .com. You had to do it all by catalog.
Sure. Well, what most people know, they're the world's largest distributor of X-rated films and lubes and toys for the bedroom. In fact, our producer said he wouldn't even know what to do with the dildo.
No, he didn't.
I mean, no, it's just crazy because it's like you intuitively, as a human being, you intuitively know what to do with the dildo.
Think you make a curry with a dildo?
No, no.
Do you think you play badminton with
a
dildo?
Absolutely. Yeah, he's blushing right now.
What do you think you're going to... What else do you think? It's pretty self-explanatory.
It's self-explanatory. Yeah. You know, but listen, they have so many toys. They have so much... Everything you can imagine, they have at AdamandEve.com.
Yes.
Plus, they have a deal going with us.
Yes.
Where if you go to that checkout and use the offer code... That's AdamandEve.com and offer code RU.
Yes.
You get free shipping and 50% off almost any item that they have.
I want to implore the women that have never experienced toys as well. They don't have to be the inserting kind if you're not comfortable with that.
Sure.
But the ones that you use on the outside, let's say.
Okay.
And the more powerful, the better.
Yes.
I am telling you, your life will be altered. And whether you're in the middle of having sex and using it during, which I love after being married for almost 18
sure.
years. Or if you're alone, they are so enriching. I'm not kidding.
Yeah.
They'll make your sex life that much better. It's not offensive to your partner.
Right.
You incorporate it and have fun with it.
Yeah.
It enriches your sex life.
That's why you should include AdamandEve.com into your ritual of sexual pleasure.
Yes.
And it, you don't even have to have another person with you.
No.
You know, you just need to know that AdamandEve.com is there for you. Use that offer code RU, that's offer code RU, and get free shipping and 50% off almost any item. Go there now, kids.
Think about Rue when you order that double-headed dildo.
We are back with Henry Rollins talking about everything. I'm so amazed at your tenacity. You have reinvented yourself time and time again. You will not go away.
No.
And you will...
You're like herpes.
You just will not go away. And... Each there's a new generation of people who become rabid fans of yours time and time again. Why do you think that is?
Oh, that's
the speaking tours, the television show.
Well, I've been lucky because I'm 54, and so I have a peer group, bands that started off around the time, like we all kind of hit the starting blocks around 79, 81 in there. A lot of these people are no longer doing music, or they're doing it differently than they did in smaller places. You know, it's, something has changed. They can't get gigs anymore.
Right.
And that sucks. Yeah, they're hardworking people. I've been very lucky. For some reason, I've never had a problem getting shows anywhere in the world at any time. I can tell any agent, can I? They're like, oh, thank you. And it goes, gets plugged in. So I've been very fortunate, and I will not ever say it's because of skill or that I'm any good. It's just, you know, it's tenacity, keeping your face in the place.
Right.
Not losing the plot, not ever, ever, ever thinking you're owed anything. Right. If you get any entitlement, just take yourself off the field because you're done.
Yeah.
If you think you're owed anything, I don't think I'm owed a damn thing. And so I've just kept that, and I keep showing up, and you eat a lot of no every audition. Nope. The thing went a different way. They're just trying to tell you, you suck.
Yeah.
But they're just trying to tell you in a polite way. Yeah, the ad went in a different way. They needed someone who could actually do it. and I never shortchange my audience, and I know the only reason I live the way I do, which is very, very well, is because of them. And so when they write me, I write them back after the show. Hey, can I talk to you, Henry? Yes. Yes, I'm exhausted. I have a 5 a.m. get up to get on a plane, but I will talk to you because you're a kid in the Midwest and you came to my show. And I don't think I owe you. I like you, youth person, because you're young and the world is hitting you in the teeth. And if you're talking to me, it means you got nowhere else to talk to.
Well, that's...
And so I've got an ear and I fear letting my audience down. I love my audience unconditionally and obsessively. And every night I go on stage, I have the sword of Damocles over my head in fear of failing them. And so I don't even bring a bottle of water out on stage because I don't want to take my eyes off them as I lean down to drink. So I have to prehydrate and rehydrate. Probably not good for your guts.
No.
But I will not go, hold on a minute, because I have this phobia. If I take a moment to drink the water, they'll get up and leave.
Yeah.
If I don't, if I take my eyes off them for a minute, they'll all go, he's not looking, go, 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 go.
Well, no, we know that's not going to happen. But how many of those shows are, what percentage are speaking engagements? And do you still do band stuff?
No music.
No music.
Many years ago, I woke up one day and I had no more lyrics. There's not one speck of toothpaste left in the proverbial tube. And I had a choice. Either go out and be the oldies machine. Hey, kids, remember this one? Well, no, my dad does. Or stop doing music and get into everything else. And thankfully, in the summer of 84, when I was 23, I saw my very talented friends, the Minutemen, Saccharine Trust, the Meat Puppets, all these great bands, Husker Du. They're all amazing, amazing, amazing. They all have day jobs when they're not on tour. I said, okay, I better get plans B, C, D, E, F, and G together. Mm-hmm. So I started working more on the writing, got into voiceover, started doing the talking shows with more, you know, really tried to get better at them. Went on acting auditions, like I'm going to try and act. You know, mm-hmm. I'm really going to find other ways to keep things happening because music is probably not going to sustain me. It actually did. I was super lucky with Rollins Band blew up. But all through the 80s, I was already doing talking shows while I was in Black Flag. I started doing voiceover while I was in Black Flag, like paid sessions. I started a book company. My book started selling. And with Rollins Band, I'm doing all of that stuff. I do 80 shows with the band, take a 10-day break to pay bills and shower, and go right back out and do the same lap on my own, paying my band back the money I owed them with 7-Eleven money orders.
Right.
Yeah. And so I was already kind of doing a lot of things. So when I stopped doing music somewhere in the 2000s, I just told the manager who nearly collapsed, like, you're going to stop doing music? I'm like, yeah. He was like, whoa, hold on a minute. That's huge. I got to keep it real. I'm not going to go up and like play last year's music, 10 years ago music, because it's not, I'm resting on laurels. That's dangerous. You can't do that.
Yeah, but I'm sure there are a lot of fans of Black Flag and of Rollins Band who would love to hear those songs.
Yeah,
again.
But I wouldn't love to hear it again. and I can't go out and do something I can't believe in 100%. I just can't. And I, of all people, I had this gentle debate with one of my favorite humans on the planet, Ozzy Osbourne, who's one of the nicest, most honest people I've ever met. He's a prince. He really is.
He is lovely.
He's a good, yeah. He's a good man. He's a great guy. And he and I said, so you go out and play Paranoid every night, like a 500-year-old song. And he said, yeah, that's what people want to hear. I said, you want to give them what they want? You want, yeah, I want to make people happy. I said, I don't particularly. I want to give them what's on my mind and in my heart at that moment. And he goes, well, I'm here to give them a good show, which I can't argue with that. It's just not for me.
Right.
I just want to give you where I'm at right now. And I don't want to go out and like, all right, folks, let's put on our Rollins Band caps and go out there and sing that song again because I was on MTV during the Reagan administration or something like that. And so I just said, I'll just see what else is out there for me. So more talking shows, more voiceover, more acting, which turned into documentary work.
Yeah.
The IFC show, which did really well. And on and on. And now I, you know, writing for the LA Weekly, Rolling Stone Australia, I continue to write and publish. I have an office and, you know, we do all of that jazz. And I was in the studio yesterday doing voiceover for a cartoon, spent 3 days before that doing TV for some summer show I'm by law not allowed to tell you about.
Yeah, yeah.
All those non-disclosure things, but I'm working.
Love it. I think it's so brilliant. And anyone who is that way, and Michelle is that way, you know, someone who lands on their feet, who can, you know, stick their finger up in the atmosphere and tell you which way the wind is blowing and how to navigate is brilliant. And your story is brilliant. What about a movie? What about a movie that would tell the story of that you told earlier of L.A., you know, 1981,
punk rock scene.
Yeah. All of that. That would be really, really great.
Because we get the punk rock scene. We don't get the America punk rock scene.
You never know, wink, wink. It might happen someday.
Sure. Right? It's a great story.
Because people can be hired to write screenplays and things can happen.
Yeah. Well, you and I did a song together. I think it was 95 or 96 or 94. I don't know. I don't remember.
One of the great angry stories of my life. And don't take that the wrong way. Working with you, I loved. Well, I'll give you it's a long story, but I'll give you the thumbnail. I met RuPaul one day at band practice, at Context Rehearsal at First and A, somewhere like that.
Yeah.
And there's this, I'm waiting for my bandmates, and this tall, handsome man is in the lounge. And he walks over, he goes, Henry Rollins. I said, yes, sir. He said, I'm RuPaul. And I have to take a moment because I'm used to the full show.
Right. Yeah, gotcha. Yeah. Okay.
But I see the cheekbones. I'm like, oh, of course you are. Yes. And we became pals immediately. He's, I'm talking about him like he's not here. He's immediately likable.
Yes.
And we just got along fine. And my bandmates walk in. I said, fellas, meet RuPaul. And my bandmates like, wow, what are you doing? He's like, I have a band. Like, I'm down the hall from you guys. And we all just became like, you know, my bandmates are really nice people. And so it came to me at some New York party while I was there, like stealing paper products and eating free food. Someone from A&M somewhere said, we want to do a record of one-hit wonders covered by interesting people. How about you and your band get together with RuPaul and do Funky Town by Lip Sync? And I said, yes, so fast my face hurt.
Right.
Yes, yeah, of course. Yeah. And suddenly my band learns the song and RuPaul and I are in a vocal booth, like smashed into a Foot Locker together.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
And we find out something very quickly. Henry can't sing and RuPaul can kind of sing anything he wants. And so he does these great vocals and they actually had to sample me because like, okay, he sang that good to sample that.
Loop it!
Hit the space bar on the and there. And so there's an outro, which is one of my favorite moments in rock and roll. And our Rollins Band sound man, Theo Van Inbergen, otherwise known as Theo Van Rock, is on the board. And RuPaul and I are in this vocal booth for like half a person. Mm-hmm. We are sweating on each other. We are chest to chest. It's getting misty in the studio inside our vocal booth. And we're like having fun ad-libbing an outro.
Right.
And we kind of get into it.
Yeah.
Like first round, two boxers kind of measuring each other.
Right. Yeah.
And Theo just looks at us like, nope. Try it again. Come on, you guys. Give it up. And by the third take, we have invented a virtual shower. RuPaul and I are going to have a shower.
Right.
And I said, Lou, look at the you. How should we take a shower and let the steam run up our bodies? And he goes, oh, yes, baby. And then I said something, God. And he said, honey, don't make promises your ass can't keep. And I said, let me wash. And the song is awesome. And so here's what happened. And this is the political. I had signed to DreamWorks. Mm. They hear this song, and it's going to be the lead track on this record. They want to do a video. I want to do it in Las Vegas on a huge stage, make it like a catwalk, and it's all about RuPaul. And he's going to be decked out, and we're just his backing band for the RuPaul show. And the record company's like, great! And so my record company, DreamWorks, said, that record's going to drop the same time your record's going to drop. We will be in direct competition with you on another major label. Please don't make us do that. We'd like you to can the song.
Oh, man.
And I said, really? It's really good. And the remix version is insanely good. It's really cool. It should be number one with a bullet everywhere there's electricity. And this is coming from David Geffen and the Wizards at the Top of the Mountain. Spielberg, you know, the mm-hmm, Katzenberg, mm-hmm. The big guys. And they said, we would strongly advise you don't do this. And that's about as they're about to take off the gloves and say, like, son, sit down.
Yeah.
Right.
And that's the last time they're going to be nice about it. And I deferred to my manager. I said, what do I do? And he said, oh, it's done. You're not putting that out. And so the press grabbed this. It was a money thing. The press grabbed it and said, they said two things. They said, DreamWorks is worried about Henry's macho, overtly heterosexual identity being marred and sullied by being in a video and on a track with a leading homosexual celebrity entertainer. And I'm like, really? You don't know me.
Yeah.
And then the Village Voice got a hold of it and said, he is not going to put out the track because he's homophobic.
Oh.
And I can take the
good old Village Voice.
I can take the, oh, he's too macho thing all day long. But when you say I'm homophobic, even now, it almost brings me to tears. Mm. Like, you really shouldn't say that about me. That insults me to my core. Mm-hmm. It insults me down to my DNA. It really, I was beside myself. And so I'm like, what? And Michael Musto, who's cool, he's taking me to task in the Village. I'm like, I don't even
know.
So
he's the one who wrote it?
Well, no, he grabbed it. And like, I don't know this guy, but I admire his, he's funny. And I am not his enemy. Like, he has no idea how I'm not his enemy.
Right.
I think we're probably cool now, but this is, you know, 20 years ago. And so I'm this pariah.
Yeah.
And so one day I'm waiting for the band members on our increasingly not going good recordings, writing sessions. And I'm waiting in the front lounge where I met RuPaul several months before. Phone rings. It's the Village Voice. They found me at band practice. Here's what we're going to release. And they already tell you. And they are going to lie. And they go, would you like to add anything to the statement? I'm like, you're not being correct.
Yeah.
Is that what you'd like to say to the Village Voice? I'm like, and then RuPaul walks in. I'm like, hey, RuPaul, the Village, I'm on the phone. I have my elbow on the counter with that blonde-haired guy.
Uh-huh.
I called him the Swede, whatever. He's a nice guy. I go, hey, RuPaul, I got Ann Powers, the Village Voice, on the phone, and she's saying I'm a homophobe and they're going to run this thing. You and I are cool, right? And he went, yes. I said, see? And I said, goodbye. And then,
oh my God.
But the thing, and so I was given a cassette of what the album was going to be, and it was so awesome. So many cool people are on it. Who's the Baywatch guy?
Oh, David Hasselhoff.
Hasselhoff's on it. And he's really funny. It's a fun album.
Right.
And the A&M or whoever was going to do it said, if you're going to pull your track, we're shelving the whole thing. Thanks a lot. And they were furious with me. And to this day, the whole thing has been shelved because of record executives who dropped me an album later.
So it never came out.
Never came out. But, you know, it's funny. You know,
it could.
It's funny that the Village Voice would say that.
He was open-minded.
Exactly. Also, if he were homo, why would he do it in the first place? Right. It doesn't make any sense.
But why couldn't they have asked me?
Right.
Like, why couldn't they just found me? I lived a second and seventh. I'm easy to find.
Well, it's just interesting how humans, a lot of times, find it easier to believe a fantasy that supports their twisted ideas of the world than it is to actually understand the truth and what would really be
you can't
what's
handle
feasible.
The truth. People don't want to know the truth.
It's
just
the
like
truth.
You said.
Yeah. You know,
they want to believe this fantasy that they've created.
It took me years to kind of be cool with the Village Voice. I just did some writing for them last year, and they're very, you know, I don't hate them. And they asked me to do a music thing, and I wrote it, and they put it in their paper, and they paid me. It was all, you know, all on the up and up. But that was just a weird time. And so that's a great, one of my favorite ever collaborations I've ever done. Maybe my single favorite, because I don't collaborate with many people. Mm. I kind of work in my own little Henry vacuum. But that was maybe the funnest thing where you play it for people and they're like, that's not out? That's ridiculous. That is so cool.
It was really cool. We did Funky Town. We right, did lip sync Funky Town, which is just outrageous.
Yeah.
Talk about punk rock.
Yeah.
And he smashes the vocal.
It's fun.
That
it's a lot of fun.
That doesn't surprise me.
Well, but you know what's interesting too? And as you were talking about this and thinking about how in the world there's so much spin and there's so much misinformation and people can run with misinformation and have the masses believe it. It must drive you crazy. You're very smart and you're very passionate. How do you maintain your equilibrium without Ritalin or drugs and alcohol in a world where everything is spun to sort of control people and keep people in this fearful place?
Well, you prioritize and you try and keep seeing. You know, I travel all over the world. I've been to like 85 countries. I've met friendly people in places that my government has told me not to go to.
Mm.
And so people, I think, homo sapiens, we are pretty cool. We're not good for much. Can't survive the cold or the heat.
Right.
And we need supermarkets and babysitters.
Yeah.
But, you know, we invent the internet and we invented John Coltrane and jazz and we're okay pretty much of the time. And so I keep seeing the better aspects of us. So you'll see that, well, if Bill and Tom get married, the world will fall off its axis and we'll go into a fiery hell. Well, I know that's not true. And so I know I won't convince you of anything, so I don't have to exactly ignore you. But I have to realize that not everyone's like you. Mm. Like, because when people say, oh, everyone's dumb these days, nah, don't take that one onto the field. Music sucks these days. Not on my radio show. Mm. I can't keep up with all the good records I'm buying that were made this year. And so you have to keep seeing that the bad is outweighed and out eclipsed by the good. And you must stay rational whenever you can. And quite often in American politics, you want to get emotional. This guy says something like, man, I want to put you over my knee and spank you.
Do you get political, Henry?
Sure. I was raised in Washington, D.C. by a mother who worked for Joseph Califano under Johnson. Of course, I'm political. Mm. I'm really political. I mean, I smelled Washington on fire as a five-year-old, you know, during the, yeah. I'm not saying I know a lot. I'm just saying, yeah.
You're opinionated.
Everything in America is political. Mm-hmm. From where you live, how much tax you pay, what school your kid's going to go to. I mean, it's all political. Mm-hmm. Americans are really political animals, depending on how much you want to get into it. But if you don't get into it, it gets into you. So you might as well get a hold of the bear before it gets a hold of you. So I'm political, absolutely. But it comes from a very constitutional, civic, civil rights sense of fair play. Like if you and I are doing the same job, why would I ever get more money than you? As a guy, as a white heterosexual male, I don't have to put up with any of that in this country. Mm-hmm. If I had to for a day, have a version said to me has no doubt been said to you in your female life of decades. Mm-hmm. I don't know how I would handle that. I don't think I would have the grace to go like, okay, I'm just going to keep on looking good and going on with my day. I'd be in jail for tearing someone's head off.
Yeah, it's difficult.
And I've said that many times from the stage. I said, you guys, if you what got you have said to a woman perhaps in your life got said to you, you'd be in a jail for assault because you would take that guy out. And so I come from that sense of fair play. Like, you know, like, again, the Bill and Tom getting married thing, marriage equality. Like if they shouldn't get married, shut up. Go back to your cubicle. And just live your mediocre life. Shut up. I mean, just it's so not part of your problem. Your life will not change. They're not having their honeymoon in your trailer home. So just please get on with it.
That's the simple explanation.
And that's basically the entirety of my politics. It's like, be fair, be cool.
And which is the way we've all been raised, which is from the musical Hair. You kids do whatever you want to do, so long as you don't hurt anybody else. And that's where I come from. But
sure.
How do you keep yourself from getting just fed up with it to the point where you just want to tear everything down? Because you are very passionate, you're very intelligent, you're very emotional. And so, how do you keep yourself from, you know, going up into a tower and saying, F you all.
Okay, well, you might not like this idea, but it's an idea that I think about a lot. I have kind of abandoned the idea of we. Because we, America, we are dysfunctional. We don't believe in science. We think the world is 500 years old or 5,000 years old and the sky's going to drop on our heads. I think science is fantastic. I think that science is going to save us all. I don't have any race problems or gender identity problems. We do. Mm-hmm. So we are done. Mm-hmm. I'm okay. You're okay. Everyone in this building is okay. So you have to get better at being being yourself and being good and letting that go viral.
Ah.
And so like a guy like my dad, who you're not going to convince, he's a PhD, knows what he knows. I mean, he's out somewhere in America clutching his AR-15, I'm sure. I'm not going to convince him that the president is not from Kenya. I'm not going to. There'll be no convincing him.
Yeah.
So it is all moot.
Yeah.
And so don't expend the calories. Don't expend the emotional calories. That guy's an editor. That's 12 seconds you're never getting back. You would have better spent it listening to a good record or laughing. So I work on me and the I. I'm not trying to be selfish. Mm-hmm. I'm not saying I don't care about you. That's the thing. I do care. I care. We don't care.
Right.
If we cared, the jails would be emptied and the schools would be full.
Right.
And so we are dysfunctional. We are still operating along the battle lines of the Civil War. We still vote along the lines of 1865. We don't care about the 13th, 14th, or 15th Amendment. So I do.
Right.
And all I can do is preach stentorian from the mount and hope to get in front of impressionable young minds who have not been closed off and sealed in cynicism or chutzpah.
Yeah.
And maybe open them up. I do that with the LA Weekly. I do that with the Rolling Stone articles. I do that with my radio show. I do that from the stage. I do that in podcasts. I do that with any person I meet. I'm cool. I'm not trying to make you cool. Mm. So I can't do that because you have a brain that wakes up every morning like mine does. So I've abandoned the we. And that's how I don't freak out on us. I do wish sometimes Texas would move.
Uh-huh.
Just completely.
But then you go to Texas and I can see my audience who are the nicest, coolest. Henry, man, thank you so much for coming here. I know it's hard on you with all of us who can't read, but we can read. I go, I know, you're cool. Your parents, they scare me, but I like you. And that's why I go back to Arkansas, Oklahoma, Mississippi, Alabama, South Carolina, Florida, Louisiana, where the politics, I don't agree where their governors are coming from, but my audience are great. All those I's, not a we in that audience. Mm-hmm. It's all a bunch of me's.
Mm-hmm.
And I like them. That's why I don't boycott states like Indiana. I'm not boycotting Indiana. I love my audience there. They're so nice. They wait in the cold to talk to me. Like, Henry, I'm freezing. What, I'm going to leave that guy because I don't like what Governor Pence did? Forget it. No way. And I've done that. You know, I go to Arizona and people came up and be like, I know you're not so hot on our governor. Thanks for not judging us. I'm like, I could never judge you. Because you're
judge
you.
An entire state by one person.
Well, don't judge the many by the actions of the few.
Yeah.
No. And that's how I keep from being the proverbial guy with the 30-odd six rifle at the top of the tower taking out UT students.
That is excellent advice. Yeah. That's excellent.
But abandoning the we, you by saying, oh, we don't matter anymore. America is we. Really? America's like 50 countries, actually.
Mm-hmm.
All on the euro. You know, basically, we all use the dollar, and you don't need a passport for now to cross borders. But it's 50 countries because of the 10th Amendment. You really do have state identity. And more with a black president, a lot of states are circling their wagons. Mm-hmm. We're not doing that healthcare thing because we like sick people. Mm-hmm. That's a great idea. And you see how much we are not that united. And you start to understand Lincoln's incredible struggle trying to keep this crazy machine from ripping itself apart by the very nature of its components.
Yeah.
And so, again, we are dysfunctional. We got work to do. But I'm pretty evolved, but always looking to evolve more. Always looking to get a little smarter, a little better, a little cooler. I'm always looking to be disabused of something that I carry around. Well, they always do that. Really? Did you just hear what you just said? Whoa. Yeah. You got to check that out, man. And thankfully, I have people in my life who I value very much. And every once in a while, I'll listen.
Yeah, well.
And the thing that sucks is they're always right.
And they're always right. Well, it's interesting. I love your philosophy because you're right. A political movement really starts on a personal level.
Yep.
The most political thing you could do is to come from your own heart and become, you know, and do...
Have an opinion,
yeah. But also walk your talk,
yep.
You know?
Yeah, everything from your bake sale to the fact that you cast a vote.
Yep.
That's you getting up off the couch and getting moving. And you can be inspired. I'm inspired. I have fans, but I am a fan. I buy people's records.
Yeah.
I go to their show. I'm like, yeah, I'm into it. I go to the merch booth. I want the T-shirt. I'm in the tank for so many musicians, so many actors and directors and artists. I'm into it. And I get inspiration from everyone from Muhammad Ali to Abraham Lincoln to a guy I will meet after a show. He goes, man, I, you know, lost my leg in Iraq, lost my wife because of my dysfunction. And thanks for the show and you keep me alive. That guy inspired me. Mm-hmm. So I'm open to get inspired from the guy at the grocery store, the taxi driver who has the most terrifying story of coming from some crazy part of the world to America. You're like, you did that to get here? I'm really glad I share a country with you, and thank you so much for the story. And so I get inspiration. I'm open to that. And so I'm just kind of a big catfish, just hoovering up lots of stuff that's around. And so you become a component part, a parts per million aerosol of everything you've tasted, touched, heard, met, saw. It's also why I travel. I meet people in Mali, South Africa, North Korea, Iran. I go to these places. I'm no expert. I meet nice people in all these places who are just, you know, they're just farmers. They're struggling. They're poor. They're terrified of their government. They love their kids. They just want it. They just want the proverbial fistful of 50s in a day without fear.
And that's not asking too much, is it?
What you see what the world is asking for is so little. It's a teaspoon. They just want some water that won't kill them, a bowl of rice, and a day without intertribal conflict, without some government guerrilla force of soldiers coming in, burning their villages to the ground.
Humans
are really happy with very little outside of the Western world. You go to parts that were like, man, I'll take that plastic bowl and a stick and I'm good, man. Thank you so much. I mean, really, it's very humbling.
It makes what we complain about in this country seem so ridiculous.
Well, the West.
Honestly.
I mean, you can kind of open that filter, that perimeter up a bit. Mm. That's Europe as well.
Yeah.
There's people who bitch about their shoes in Germany.
I
mean, like, there's a lot of...
Yes.
And then you go to other parts of the world where there's no shoes. I was sitting with some Acholi tribesmen in northern Uganda a few years ago, and I was with a guy, ex-South Sudanese soldier, fighting the North. Anyway, he speaks the local, and I said, I want to talk to these people. I said, do you have any words in your language for insurance? And they're like, what's that? And I have to explain insurance through this guy, this ex-soldier. I go, do you have a retirement? And they're like, well, kind of. When you're too old to get the water, your children get it for you. Mm-hmm. And your son's wife takes care of you. And then their children take care of you. I go, do you have a vacation? And that they're like, what? I said, you get in a plane and you go somewhere and you sip overpriced drinks and get skin damage from too much sun. And then you go back to your life and watch HBO from a different building. And they're like, nope, we have no idea what you're talking about.
Yeah.
Sometimes the young son will leave to the city to try and make it as a doctor or a scholar. But a vacation. And they're like, you can't even explain it. They're like, why would you leave home?
Yeah.
Vacate from what? Yeah. Huh? Mm-hmm. You can't leave the sun. It's right. It's there all the time.
Yeah.
And you see how different you are. Not bad. I'm not putting us in the pejorative. I'm just saying we're super different. And at one point, this soldier guy went to his home and met his wife and his kids. They're just wonderful. And, you know, his chicken's running around. I go, so this is your house. I said, where's your bathroom? He points to some thing down the road. And he said, Henry, how many toilets do you have? And I said, listen, I must be honest. I had to take a moment and count them.
Uh-huh.
1, 2, 3, 4, 5? And I kind of winced when I said that. And he kind of went, wow, that must be really nice. I said, if you ever visit L.A., come over and hang out. We'll flush all of them, man.
It's amazing what we take for granted.
We
really do take it for granted until you're there. We just came back from Iceland and being in Reykjavik, a very small nation, 300,000 mm-hmm. people. They are so loving and open. I think they have an out head of state or, you know, somebody uh-huh. in the government, openly gay. And they're just a happy nation. And they didn't say anything except, thank you for coming to Iceland. Thank you for coming to Iceland. So grateful that you're coming to them to entertain them. Small, happy, loving. And then you come back and you're like, they're really not complaining about anything there.
Well, I am not complaining about having you guys here. You're both gorgeous, fabulous people. Henry Rollins, thank you so much for coming and talking to us. You are such not only a national treasure, you're an international, intergalactic treasure.
There you go.
I'll take that.
And I am
from you.
I am so happy to call you a friend.
And you are my friend too.
Thank you so much. Thank you, Michelle.
I love you, baby.
Until next time.
Yeah, bye.
Can I get an amen? Can I get an amen? If you can't love yourself, how in the hell you gonna love somebody else? Can I get an amen? And don't forget to subscribe on iTunes. If you can't love yourself, how in the hell you gonna love somebody else? Eh, eh.